Okay, welcome once again. This is Richard Klemm. We're coming to you live today with a telephone conference call on July 21st. And we are also making this program available as part of our podcast program. So welcome to our podcast listeners as well. As I mentioned, everybody taking the call today, whether you're doing it live or whether you're doing it as part of the podcast, I'm going to be giving four code numbers during the course of the program. When you hear those, please write them down, and at the conclusion of the program, email them to me, or you can give me a call, or send them by U.S. mail, or whatever works for you. Just send me those four code numbers to clem.law@usa.net, which that address is also on my website, and I will use that to take attendance so that I know that you are here in case it's ever, if I'm ever asked. And also I'll let you know the event codes and so forth for you to report online. So like I say, I'll be giving those four code numbers and just email them to me at the end of the program. Also, for the podcast listeners, if you do have any substantive questions about the program, feel free to email me or give me a call. My number is 612-378-7751, or you can email me at clem.law@usa.net. And if you have any substantive questions about the program, I'm available to answer those usually the same day I get the question. Today's program, we're going to be looking at some recent decisions of the Minnesota appellate courts that were handed down between mid-May and June. The first case from the Supreme Court that we're going to take a look at is Leyendecker. Leyendecker versus Asian Women United of Minnesota. This is a case construing the Minnesota Anti-SLAPP Statute, S-L-A-P-P. It stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. The Minnesota legislature enacted this statute a few years ago, basically to provide an avenue of relief to people who were being who felt that they were being sued for no reason other than that they were taking part in public affairs. So somebody, you know, testifies before the city council, or they send a letter to their legislator, as a result, they get slapped with a lawsuit. Well, the Minnesota anti-slap statute was designed to kind of correct that problem by basically, if the defendant is going to be the person who brings a motion under the anti-slap statute. If the defendant basically establishes kind of a prima facie case saying that, yes, this comes under the elements of the anti-slap statute. I was served with this lawsuit because I was participating in some kind of public activity. Well, then at that point, the district court holds a preliminary motion, and basically the burden of proof is upon the plaintiff at that point. To show that there's enough evidence to go forward. And it even kind of suspends the discovery process. So you can't, the plaintiff is not allowed to simply say, well, we don't have the evidence right now, but we're going to, I plan on getting that in the discovery process. Well, no, if the defendant meets the burden of showing that it qualifies under the anti-slap statute, that's not a defense, which is one of the points raised here. And this case, this Leyendecker case, basically makes clear that the burden of proof does shift. So that, well, I guess the burden of proof is always on the plaintiff, but the burden of proof at this preliminary stage is on the plaintiff to show that they have enough evidence to go forward. So if you have any cases involving public participation and you need to see the construction of that SLAPP, anti-SLAPP statute, that Leyendecker case is the most recent construing that. Now, it's not that new of a statute, so I think there's some other cases on point. But that's the most recent one talking about it. So anti-slap statute. The next topic, I guess, in a case handed down the same day, June 25th, about 3 weeks ago. Well, the Minnesota, land of 10,000 taxes. We have a lot of taxes up here. One of our taxes in Minnesota is a tax on commercial waste. So if you have a dumpster out behind your retail establishment, There is a tax that you have to pay for generating your commercial waste, and that tax is collected by your garbage collector. I don't know, they don't call themselves garbage collectors anymore. I guess waste management contractors. Oh, waste management service provider is what they're called. One thing I learned here is that this applies to any commercial generator of waste, including a home-based business. So I operate out of my home here, so I guess I have to be careful not to use the house dumpster for my law office trash, because then I would be subject to this tax. But just about all the trash that I generate in my law office is stuff that I shred and recycle, so I guess I'm not subject to this tax. But I think it's like 60 cents per cubic yard or something like that. Well, the holding in this case is that when the there are various, how exactly do you measure how many cubic yards of trash some business is generating? I mean, you can't go out there and measure the waste every single time. So the statute gives a number of alternative ways they can do that. The simplest of which is just you have this size dumpster, so we operate on the assumption that it's full every month, and that's how much we charge. And there are a number of alternatives. Or if they want to, they can go in and measure meticulously and charge the exact amount for the number of cubic yards you were generating. Well, the holding in this case is that they, whatever method they choose of the permissible methods under the statute, they have to use the same method that they use for their actual billing. So if they are billing you for a one cubic yard dumpster, and that's what the billing is, well, then they have to charge you the tax on that full cubic yard. They can't just wait till the truck gets back to the transfer point and say, well, it looks like all of our dumpsters were only half full this month, so we're only going to pay, instead of for one cubic yard for all of our businesses, we're only going to pay for half a cubic yard for all of our businesses. The holding in this case, like I say, is simply that they have to do that computation consistently. They have to do the computation the same way as they do their billing. I imagine most businesses are probably billed for the size of the dumpster, so that means that amount can be rather significant, and this waste management company in Monticello, they wound up with something like $80,000 in arrearages they had to pay. So it was a non-trivial amount. These 60 cents here and there, they all add up. So if you, in last week's program, we had another a sales tax issue. That was on sales tax for rentals, ruling in favor of the Department of Revenue in that case as well. So here's another one. Basically, you can't reduce your tax obligation through creative accounting unless you use that same creative accounting when you actually bill people. Turning to criminal cases, I guess there were no cases on June 18th, but we had one case handed down, a criminal case, on June 11th, and that was the Auk case. Now, if you were here for Friday's program, you remember that we had the Roman Nose case, Roman Nose versus State of Minnesota, discussing the retroactivity of Miller v. Alabama. Miller v. Alabama was a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2012, which held that it was not the clearest of holdings, but it said that somebody sentenced to life without parole for an offense that they committed as a juvenile was the issue in that case. And the Miller court did not say outright that cruel and unusual punishment automatically. However, they said that there were some kind of specific things that the sentencing court had to look at when doing sentencing like that. The issue in the case we had last week, Roman Nose, was the retroactivity of that case. And they held, I think, though, with a little bit of wiggle room, that the Miller v. Alabama was not to be retroactively applied in the state of Minnesota. But as I promised last week, there would probably be some more litigation coming out of those issues. And sure enough, here's one of those cases just a few weeks later. And the Alk case, well, here we had somebody bring a petition for post-conviction relief because he was sentenced for the crime of murder when he was 15 years old. In fact, I remember this crime. This was the a robbery of two gas stations on West 7th. If you're ever driving from downtown St. Paul to the airport, I forget what the cross street is, but there's a Total gas station on the right and an Amoco station on the left. Well, they robbed both of those, and unfortunately at the Amoco station, they murdered everybody. Or I guess they killed two people, but there were two people severely wounded. And I remember that that crime happening. But this gentleman was convicted of murder in connection with that robbery. He was 15 years old at the time. Well, he was sentenced to life, not without the possibility of parole. He had the possibility of parole after 30 years. And he said, well, you know, that's really close enough to life without parole. Because you know, I'm going to be 45 years old by the time, so that's basically life without parole. But the Minnesota Supreme Court said no. The Miller v. Alabama case does not apply to your case. That applied strictly to people who were sentenced to life without parole, and life with the possibility of parole after 30 years simply did not not qualify for that. The next case, I guess we're back to May now. I guess on the week of Memorial Day, it looks like they didn't have any cases. The next one, you probably this one was they was being talked about on talk radio. Everybody had an opinion about this one. Axelberg versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. This was an implied consent case. Somebody, she was driving over the legal limit, and she had, she was charged with DWI. The DWI, the record here does not indicate that, but apparently that was pleaded down to careless driving, and she apparently pleaded guilty to that, just from what I heard on news reports. But also she was, she had her driver's license taken away. Well, she asserted the necessity defense. She wanted to assert the necessity defense because, and it seemed like she had a pretty solid case, she was, this took place over the Memorial Day weekend. She and her husband were staying at a place about a mile from a resort where they had been drinking. There had been alcohol involved, so the husband was apparently drunk, and she was at least over the legal limit for driving. And they got back to where they were staying, and they got involved in some kind of domestic altercation. And from reading the facts of the case, it sounds like the husband kind of went crazy, and he was just going to beat her within an inch of her life, possibly even kill her. Now, interestingly, in this case, I think it's very clear to me from the facts of the case is that if she had a firearm with her at that point, I think she probably would have been justified in shooting her husband dead. And at the very least, she would have been able to present the defense of self-defense at her jury trial. And quite possibly, she would have been acquitted of murder if she would have used lethal force against her husband. But she did not use lethal force because she didn't have a weapon, and she was kind of trapped in the car because when the husband started going psycho, she locked herself in the car because she couldn't get to the house or to the cabin where they were staying because he was in the way. So she thought the safest course of action would be to lock herself in the car. She didn't have a telephone with her. She didn't have a weapon with her. Cause like I say, I think she would have been justified in using the weapon. She didn't have any of those things, but she was locked there in the car. And then the husband started smashing the windshield like he was going to get into the car. So what she decided to do was, you know, maybe I should get out of here. So she started the car, and she drove back to the nearest business, a mile away, the place where they had been drinking, the resort. And when they got there, she called 911. The husband followed, and he was arrested in the parking lot. Somebody called 911 from there that this psycho was chasing this woman. The cops got there, and they arrested him for assault or whatever, and they arrested her for DWI because she had driven that 1 mile. There was no question about that. And she was drunk. So, like I say, the criminal case is not was not before us here. Although, like I say, I understand that was pleaded down. But the issue was, can she raise the defense of necessity in that case? If this had been a criminal case, clearly she would have been able to raise the defense of necessity. So, or like I say, if she had shot him, she would have been able to raise the self-defense defense. But instead, she had driven her car. The criminal case was not before him, and she sought to introduce evidence of necessity. Yes, I was violating the implied consent law by driving drunk, but I was driving as carefully as I can, and I was in fear of my life. The district court, I believe, held that was not permissible. She was not allowed to present that defense, and here the Supreme Court agrees that she was not allowed to present the defense of self-defense. Because if you look at the implied consent statute, it says the hearing shall be limited to the following issues. And, you know, you read through the list of issues that are permissible at that hearing, and they are things like, you know, did the cop actually read the implied consent advisory, and was she, you know, was there probable cause to make the stop? And it's a very specific list of issues that can be raised at that hearing, and one of the issues on that list is not whether you can raise the defense of necessity. So the Supreme Court, just as a matter of statutory construction, said, well, that's not one of the issues properly before the court in that kind of case. Therefore, the defense of necessity is not available. There was a dissenting opinion by Justice, I believe they all, there were, well, let's see, there were one, two, three, yeah, there were three judges dissenting. I think there were two separate opinions. And Justice Page said that, I have a tendency to agree with him on this one, the court's ruling failed to adhere to the court's constitutional mandate to do justice, because somewhere in the Minnesota Constitution it says that the Supreme Court is going to supposed to do justice. And notwithstanding the implied consent statute, I have my doubts whether justice was done in that particular case. So like I say, that was widely talked about. Your friends were probably asking you about that case on Facebook. Kind of an interesting case that came down recently. I guess before I forget, I better give our first code number for today's program. The first code number for this portion of the program is C107. C107. C as in Charlie 107. C107 is the first code word for this portion of the program. Let's see, the final Minnesota Supreme Court case. One thing about Minnesota Supreme Court is most of their decisions are discretionary. You know, they're discretionary whether the Supreme Court can take them, for that reason, most cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court, it's safe to say, are important cases. This next one, on the other hand, is probably important only to the litigants. It's a post-conviction relief case where they didn't really hold anything other than, no, he didn't meet his burden of showing post-conviction relief was appropriate. And that is because all first-degree murder cases automatically go to the Minnesota Supreme Court. So that's why you occasionally have some case here that not a very very much precedential nature. But the they have to take them, and the Minnesota Supreme Court, basically all of their opinions are published. But not too much to hold there, just on the facts of that particular case. Well, they held that the post-conviction petition was time-barred in that case. Well, turning to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, we have Bass versus Equity Residential Holdings. Well, if you're the attorney for a landlord, well, you have to do everything right when you go to housing court. You have to be careful, and there are procedural things that you have to follow. And if you don't follow those procedural rules, there might be consequences such as damages. And that's what happened in this case. Ms. Bass got evicted from her apartment. I think it was Hennepin County. But she got evicted. Yeah, I went to Hennepin County Housing Court, she wasn't able to come up with the money. So the court signed an order saying that the landlord was entitled to recovery of the premises. But that order is not enough. They have to go to the sheriff, or they have to go to the clerk's office and get a writ of recovery, and then they have to do whatever they have to do with that to have the eviction carried out. Well, they didn't bother following those steps. They didn't pay the filing fee for that writ either. What they did is she just went to work one morning, and when she got home, the locks had been changed. And they said, "Well, you abandoned your apartment." Yeah, we didn't finish doing all this stuff, but you had abandoned the place because you left at 8 in the morning. And sometime between 8 o'clock and 5 p.m., we determined that you had abandoned the premises. So we just put all of your stuff in the dumpster. Well, that's not what you're supposed to do when you go through an eviction process. She filed a petition in housing court saying, "Well, I was locked out in violation of the statute." And the court agreed with her and awarded her damages of about $10,000 for all of her personal possessions that had gotten lost in the dumpster. Well, on appeal, the landlord argued, "Well, you know, we like housing court. We like going there because it's an expedited process. But we didn't realize that we could actually get a judgment against us. We think the housing court is there simply to handle eviction cases, not to award damages. So we take the position that the housing court lacks jurisdiction to award monetary damages." Well, the Court of Appeals disagreed with that, and they by pointing out that the court was it's a division of the district court, and the district court in Minnesota is our court of general jurisdiction. So they held that that was the proper procedure that was followed in that case by the Hennepin County Housing Court, and they were liable for damages. Another criminal case here, State v. Miller. Somebody saw a vehicle driving erratically, they called the cops. The cops found the car just as they were pulling into what was apparently their own driveway. Kind of unclear, but they were pulling into a private garage. The police officer approached them, instead of saying "Yes, officer," "No, officer," "I'm sorry, officer," the defendant wasn't quite that polite, and she was given a preliminary breath test, was a 0.195, well over twice the limit. She was placed under arrest, she did not go along with the arrest, and all kinds of stuff happened. He tased her, brought her down to the station. She refused the breath test. She was charged with DWI, and she actually pleaded guilty to the DWI, and she was sentenced, and the sentence was stayed. So uh, She kind of forgot about it, but in the meantime, she had this implied consent proceeding pending in the same Hennepin County District Court, but actually before a different judge, the implied consent case to get her driver's license back. And so, I don't know, somehow she did a little bit better in that case, and the court in the implied consent case held that that arrest was invalid. And since the arrest was invalid, the refusal to take the breath test was not was justified. You don't have to, I guess, you don't have to take a breath test if you're ordered to, if you after an illegal arrest. So therefore, she got her driver's license back, part of the implied consent proceeding. Well, then the trial judge in the criminal case, sua sponte, somehow got out the file of the implied consent case. Realized that the arrest was invalid, and notwithstanding the guilty plea, just vacated the conviction, and threw out the criminal case as well, without a motion by the defendant, as far as I can tell, sua sponte threw the case out. So I don't. I'm guessing something was going on there behind the scenes, but not really clear. Well, the only issue in this case, the city of Champlin, who was prosecuting the case, they had been, as part of the plea agreement, they had been given $750 in costs. So the trial judge held a hearing on the issue of whether or not the $750 should be returned, even though that issue had already, I don't know why the trial court bothered with this hearing anyway, because it sounds like the judge made up their mind on that issue as well. But anyway, the trial court threw it out and ordered the city of Champlin to return the $750. Well, that was, I guess, a little bit too much for them, so they decided to appeal this case to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The trial judge had no jurisdiction to just sua sponte go in and throw out the case based upon the file in a separate, albeit related, case. And the Court of Appeals agreed on that. So the city got their $750 back. And also it vacated that, or it reversed that decision, essentially reinstating the guilty plea and reinstating the conviction in the criminal case. Let's see, I think we have one or maybe two cases about conditional release of sex offenders. I don't know. These are, if you're involved in that sort of thing, you know, the sentencing when it comes to sex offenders is kind of complicated. But Minnesota statute has either lifetime or a period of years, a period of conditional release, which is kind of an automatic term that has to be added to the sentence of any sex offender. And this case kind of construing that. The thing that stood out about me, there's not too much law here, but the defendant in this case, though, it really stood out to me. I don't know what's going on behind the lines here. Like I say, there's not too much precedent that we have to worry about here. It's just kind of a statutory construction here. But this defendant molested two children ages 3 and 5 in two separate incidents. Oh, and the question was whether or not one was a prior offense, because they were charged at the same time. So basically the holding of the case was that, no, you don't go with a lifetime conditional release period because he did not have a prior offense of the same type, because they were both before the sentencing court at the same time. But it just kind of struck me, I always try to defend our district judges, saying that they're not soft on crime, but I kind of wonder what's going on here, because for molesting those two children, it was first degree criminal sexual conduct, so I don't know what the facts of the case were, but his sentence was basically a year in the county jail. He was sentenced to the overall sentence was 172 months and 72 months, But that was suspended, and like I say, I found just by wondering about that, looking in the local newspaper, it included 1 year in the county jail. But that seems like kind of a little bit of a soft sentence for that offense. So maybe there, I don't know, maybe there were more facts that I'm not aware of. But like I say, it's kind of a tight factual situation. It's probably not of interest in general practitioners too often. One thing that's on everybody's mind, though, is frac sand. A few weeks ago, we had a case from the Wisconsin courts talking about frac sand because we have the oil boom going on in North Dakota. And, well, we don't have any oil here in Minnesota, but they need a lot of sand to get that oil out of the ground out there. And there's sand in them there hills in both Wisconsin and Winona County, Minnesota. And in Winona County, Minnesota, the owners of this property wanted to open a frac sand mine. I don't know that when you call it a... You know, when you call it, Tom's Frac Sand Mine, Inc., they put a big sign there. Well, the neighbors got up in arms about that because they should come up with a better term for that, frac sand. That does sound kind of nasty. But basically just taking sand out of the ground that's going to be used in the oil mining process in North Dakota. And the question is, in this case, was whether or not there has to be a environmental impact statement, because they went to the county board of Winona County and got a conditional use permit, and the issue was whether or not an environmental impact statement was required. After a fair amount of deliberation, the county board held that it was not. And they eventually issued the conditional use permit, I believe, with some conditions. Basically, the test here is outlined in the court's holding, whether the potential cumulative effect of that use of the property is significant both by itself and viewed in connection with other things in the area. Mitigation measures. So it lists the factors here, and it's a pretty long, fact-intensive 24-page opinion where the court examined that and agreed with the county board that the environmental impact statement was not required in that case. I don't believe I've given the second code number. The second code number for today's program to send in for your certificate of attendance is C253. C as in Charlie, 253. C253 is the second code number for record your attendance. Next, we turn to the Minnesota Data Practices Act. For those of you who might be in other states, a lot of other states, I think they might use the terminology Freedom of Information Act. The Minnesota Data Practices Act is basically our version of the Freedom of Information Act. It entitles people, members of the public and members of the press, such as Star Tribune Media, which is the largest newspaper in the state, it entitles them to access to certain public data, very similar to the Federal Freedom of Information Act, from government agencies. Well, the issue in this case is whether the Minnesota Joint Underwriting Association was a state agency for purposes of that statute. The Minnesota Joint Underwriting Association is basically, kind of a pool of insurance companies who issue insurance to people who are excluded by other companies. Insurance companies doing business in the state are required to be a member of the Minnesota Joint Underwriting Association, and it's governed by a board, and eight members of that board are appointed by the Minnesota Commissioner of Commerce. So of these 15 members, 8 are appointed by the state, basically. And I guess the other 7 members are probably elected. I'm not sure of the details, but it appears that they're elected by the insurance companies who are members of the Minnesota Joint Underwriting Association. So the question was, is that a state agency? And the Court of Appeals held that no, the Minnesota Joint Underwriting Association is not a state agency. And one thing that it kind of hinged on was the fact that it was called an association. You know, an association is something that that people join. And so it's kind of a private entity, even though it's required by state law and the state government controls a majority of the board. Even so, it was held to be an association, not just because they used the word association in the abstract, but the Minnesota has naming conventions for state agencies, whether something is supposed to be called a commission or a board or whatever. Well, there's a naming convention for that from the in the state statutes. Well, association is not one of the words on that list. So that was kind of the thing that tipped the scale, I think, in this case, that, well, no, this is an association. It's not a, you know, it's not a board or a commission or anything like that. It's just an association, and associations are not bound by the Data Practices Act, or like I say, what those of you in other states might call the Freedom of Information Act. And that was the holding in that case. Another one, they're probably a little bit more used to the day-to-day practitioner, is our next case, the SN4 case. SN4 LLC versus Anchor Bank. We have the Minnesota, the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, which basically says that you can sign documents electronically. And basically anything that you can sign with a pen and ink, you can sign electronically. And basically what the court looks at, what the statute looks at, is did the parties intend to sign this document? Well, here in the negotiations for the purchase of a piece of real property, the buyers were buying it from the bank. I guess it was a foreclosed property, and they were haggling and negotiating and significantly circulating back and forth drafts of a purchase agreement. So the attorney for the buyers emailed the bank saying, you know, we want you to change paragraph 4 of the attached document. And the bank emailed back saying, well, okay, we agree to making that change to paragraph 4. Well, the document was never actually signed. And in fact, the buyer's attorneys, one of the things that they were doing was these emails were saying things like, well, when are we going to see a signed copy of the agreement? And that was kind of a significant fact. But the deal fell through, and the bank decided not to sell. But these potential buyers went to court saying, well, no, we had a binding agreement, because at some point there was a meeting of minds, and at some point in all these various emails, these emails constituted an electronic signature, and they pointed at emails saying that, you know, attached is the agreement that we are going to agree to, or words to that effect, and that email was signed. Well, the what they tried to do is hook their hat on that, on those emails, saying that, well, those emails had a signature, and they evinced an intent to sign the underlying document. So therefore, that email, along with the Word document that was attached to it, taken together, constitute a signed document. And from a legal point of view, I think it's safe to say that the court agreed that that could have taken place. So if one of these emails had said exactly what I said right now, attached is the document, and yes, we do agree to this document, and we will be signing it, and we will mail you a fully executed copy later today. Well, that probably would have been enough to constitute an electronic signature. But it was kind of a fact-intensive look at it, and this case doesn't really so much construe that Electronic Transfers Act or Electronic Transactions Act. Really more what it does is just kind of a fact-intensive look saying, well, yes, there was something here that was a signature, but it was not a signature to the final document. And in fact, what they pointed to was that the buyers they pointed to those emails where the buyers were getting very antsy saying, when are we going to get a signed copy of the agreement? And that eventually turned out to be never. So if there had been an email back saying, well, thank you, it looks like we have a deal now, so we're not worried about getting that signed agreement anymore, that would have been a little bit different. But here, based upon just the facts of the case, they held that there was not enough to constitute an electronic signature of the actual document. Divorce cases, those of you out of state, there's probably a similar concept in your state, but here in Minnesota, in divorce cases, we have something called a Karen waiver, based upon this Karen case, K-A-R-O-N, 1989 case. And what a Karen waiver is in Minnesota is the parties in executing a marital termination agreement include a provision in there called the Karen waiver, in which they say, the husband and the wife hereby agree that the district court shall be hereby divested of jurisdiction to hear any more issues about spousal maintenance or property issues. You really can't do it with regard to child support, but on the property issues of the case, the parties execute a Karen waiver saying that the district court is hereby forever divested of jurisdiction. The Karen case from 1989 holds that that is valid. This case reiterates that those will be relentlessly applied. So no matter how profound the change of circumstances, the spouse agreed to waive spousal maintenance, but then circumstances changed. In the normal course of events, that spouse could come in and say, because of these changed circumstances, I want more spousal maintenance. Under a Karen waiver, the court is not allowed to consider that because the court no longer has jurisdiction. And as the case makes clear, as the judge says here, today's decision is an additional reminder, if one were necessary, that a Karen waiver should only be entered into carefully and thoughtfully because it will be enforced. And kind of the interesting thing that happened here was that the clear holding of this case is that you can't, that Karen waiver, once it's in, you can't agree, even the parties by agreement cannot reinvest the district court with jurisdiction. So here, what happened in this case was that one of the parties said, I'm going to voluntarily take less spousal maintenance than I'm otherwise required to take. Notwithstanding that Karen waiver, we're going to go into court, and we were entitled to, $5,000 a month in spousal maintenance, but I hereby agree that we're going to knock that down to $1,600 per month. The court went in, and the court even agreed to that, signed it, and so forth. And then that spouse changed her mind about whether she wanted to agree to that reduction. So she went back to court and say, "No, judge, you know what? I want you to reinstate the original $5,000." The holding in this case was that intermediate reduction, even though both parties agreed to it, was invalid because the court, in entering that order, violated the Karen waiver. So that original spousal maintenance was reimposed. Now, it seems to me that that result could have been avoided in that case, because once that Karen waiver is already in effect, this case makes clear that you can't get another order at variance from that. So I think what the parties should have done was simply, had an ancillary promissory note saying that, I will continue to pay the $5,000 a month in spousal maintenance, but you hereby promise to pay me as a totally separate contractual obligation $3,400 per month. And I think that would have given some protection to the other spouse, because while the other spouse could still execute against that original $5,000 in spousal maintenance, but then at least he can go back and get some of his money back elsewhere. So I think the result probably could have been avoided in that case, although it still would have been kind of a messy situation. But Karen waivers, that case makes clear that they will definitely be enforced in Minnesota. Let's see, civil commitment. Sex offenders in Minnesota are often, after serving their sentence, are civilly committed. Here the civil commitment was affirmed on the facts of this case. Another supervised release in a sex offender case, the Myers case. So we'll kind of probably gloss over that. Another criminal case, State v. Well, and this was a second-degree murder case. So I went to the Minnesota Court of Appeals and not directly to the Minnesota Supreme Court. But here he was convicted of murder after a barroom brawl. His defense at trial was, I was acting in self-defense. But the jury didn't buy that, and he was convicted. He had objected at trial to the introduction of evidence of three prior assault cases. The district court had allowed evidence of his conviction of assault in three prior cases. The Minnesota Court of Appeals held that was not proper, introducing those, because the only issue, there was no dispute as to, I did deliver the punch that proved fatal, so it wasn't a question of, some other person doing it. The only issue in the case was whether or not it was self-defense. So those three assault convictions from the past were really not relevant on the issue of whether or not the other person was the aggressor. So the Minnesota Court of Appeals reversed the conviction from St. Louis County in that case. The O'Brien case here, guardianship. This was a guardianship of this 27-year-old gentleman who suffered from some mental issues. He had bipolar disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and a guardianship had been in effect earlier. So his property was being handled by the guardians, who I believe were his parents. But he wanted to get married to this young woman he had met, and the guardians, who I believe were his parents, objected to that. So he went to court, and basically the holding of the Court of Appeals here was that the right to marry is a fundamental civil right in this state. It could potentially be taken away in this guardianship proceeding, but the burden of proof is squarely on the other side. So presumptively, he should be. The court should have granted his request to be married, unless the guardian came forward with some kind of specific evidence of what was going on. The next code number for this portion of the program is C319. C as in Charlie, 319. C319. Is the next code number for this portion of the program. If you're not involved in agriculture. The case that follows here probably isn't too relevant to you, but I guess if you represent farmers, well, they're the EPA is doing more and more to get involved in the lives of farmers. And as pointed out in this case, in Pope County, he owned this. He farmed about 4,000 acres. 4,000 acres of in crops, and he also had a feedlot, and he also had about 400 acres of pasture. Well, there are different. If you operate a feedlot, so if you have basically all of your cattle packed into one little area, and you're feeding them, getting them ready to take to slaughter, well, that can be kind of a messy proposition. So I guess it's probably right that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency probably a good idea that they regulate that, and you. Because you're going to be generating a lot of manure over a fairly small parcel of land, and well, that can cause some pollution issues in the nearby waters. So I guess that that seems kind of reasonable. But the statute has a has an exemption that well, no, you don't need though to have a you don't need to get the PCA's blessing just to send your cows out to pasture. You know, and you think of this pastoral scene, these cows out there foraging in the grass. Well, you shouldn't need Pollution Control Agency permission to do that. What the operator was doing, well, he had kind of these part-time pastures. He would use them for pasturing at some times, but other times he would use this land for other purposes. And they said, "Well, no, you didn't fit within the definition of pasture within the meaning of the statute." and they took a strict look at the definition, and the definition is that the livestock basically have to be there throughout the winter. So here. He had the cattle in this relatively small area, so the Court of Appeals held, no, that's not a pasture. That's closer to a feedlot, you need PCA approval for that. If you do DWI cases, you'll want to take a look at the St. John case. Basically, she was convicted of two offenses, and the question of which was the lesser included and which was the greater included. So the court kind of takes a look at what was she convicted of? She was convicted of two offenses for refusal to submit because they didn't have any blood or breath test. So she was charged with driving after refusing to submit to a breath test, but also for the substantive offense of drunk driving, and she pleaded guilty. And it was kind of unclear which offense she was pleading guilty to, but the trial court sentenced her to the refusal to take the test, even though she desired to be sentenced to the actual DWI. So the question of well, which one is the lesser included offense in this case? This case kind of resolves that issue. I see we have a couple of minutes left, so we'll just, first of all, those of you taking this program for Wisconsin credit are hereby excused because you have your full 50 minutes in. But what I will do here real quickly is just pull up some of the cases that we'll be talking about, because I do have another program coming up next week on the 28th, I don't have the it's scheduled yet, but I think we'll just continue on, look at some more recent decisions of the Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court. While I'm waiting for my computer to recover here, I will just remind everybody that I have one more code number to go here in about the next 2 minutes. So we'll get to that in about 2 minutes. And my computer finally recovered here. so we can look at some of these other cases. And I guess the one we'll look at is a case from last week, Citizens State Bank of Norwood Young America versus Brown. And there's a link to this on my webpage. If you go to richardclem.com, on the very first page, it'll say something like recent case summaries. But this case looks at the Minnesota Fraudulent Conveyance Statute. And here, the pretty clear that to me that it was a fraudulent conveyance for purposes of the statute. Well, there's no overt fraud necessarily, but somebody was trying to avoid creditors by making a transfer. And if it had been part of any other kind of transaction, it's pretty clear that it fit within the Minnesota Fraudulent Conveyance Statute. But here the issue was, well, wait a minute, this was not a an arm's-length transaction between two people. It was actually a settlement of our divorce case. Because Mr. Brown here was, he died while the appeal was pending. He was 93 years old. So Mr. Brown was 93 years old. He had been married for 25 years, and his wife was 55 years old. So I guess when his wife, but they had been married for 25 years. I guess when the wife was 30, that's 93 minus 25, it'd be 78. So he was 78. She was 30, and they married, and it lasted for 25 years. But for whatever reason, when he was 93, they wound up in divorce court, and there was a marital termination agreement, and lo and behold, the wife got everything. But his creditors didn't get anything. So the argument here was, well, that's a fraudulent conveyance just as much as any other fraudulent conveyance. The mere fact that it was part of a marital termination agreement does not take it out of the ambit of the Minnesota Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. So that was the holding in that case. Citizens State Bank versus Brown. And like I say, we'll probably be looking at that in a little bit more detail in next week's part of the program. Well, with about 2 minutes left here, I'm just going to unmute it. For anybody taking the program live today, if you have any questions on any of those cases we talked about. Well, I hear
conference
none.
Muted.
So I thank you all for attending the live program today. And as promised, the final code number for your certificate of attendance, for to report attendance, is C496. C496 is the final code word for both the podcast and the conference call. The last code word for this portion of the program is C496. So thank you once again for attending today's program, either by conference call or podcast, and I do look forward to seeing you at future programs.